KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. From a very young age, the writer Helen MacDonald had been obsessed with birds of prey. When she was 12, she first saw trained falcons hunting in a field, and she says she knew one day she would become a falconer. And she did. But even then, she never wanted to work with a goshawk. She had seen those birds, and they unnerved her. In her memoir, she describes goshawks as things of death and difficulty, spooky, pale-eyed psychopaths. She says she'd never seen anything of herself reflected in those murderous eyes, but then the world changed. Her father died, and training and flying a goshawk became inevitable, is how she puts it. Her book is about her goshawk. She called her Mabel, and she became a mirror for her grief. Helen MacDonald is coming to Utah this week. Today on the program, she'll join us to talk about her book, H is for Hawk, after the news.
Hello, podcast listener. It's Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show is a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER Spring Fun Drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support KUER, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join us for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org. And thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Helen MacDonald's acclaimed book, H is for Hawk, is a memoir about her relationship with a goshawk. Mabel, she called her. And there's some logic in that name. Among falconers, there's a superstition about giving fearsome names to these fearsome birds. The idea is that their hunting ability is somehow inversely proportional to the ferocity of their name. So Odin or Slayer won't do. But Tiddles or Baby Doll, that could work. Mabel means lovable or dear. It was a word as far from death as MacDonald could get, even though it was death that brought her to the bird in the first place. Helen MacDonald is a research scholar at the University of Cambridge in England. She also has three collections of poetry, and she's in Utah today. We'll tell you more about that in a moment. She spoke with us yesterday from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. As her book begins, Helen is about to leave the house one evening when the phone rings. It was her mother who said hello and then paused, and it was in the pause she knew her father was dead.
She just said, I had a phone call from St. Thomas's Hospital, and there was a kind of timbre and quality to her voice that I'd never heard before, and I knew at that instant that my father had died. It was just total realization. And I also realized at that point why people say when they're about to deliver bad news, you know, are you sitting down? Because my knees just gave way and I was on the carpet in my house. You know, I couldn't stand up. It was a very, very intense and awful moment.
Well, and particularly because no one, of course, was expecting it at all.
Yeah, my father, it was a massive heart attack. He was a press photographer. He'd been out taking photographs in London and had this heart attack, and he was just suddenly gone. I mean, it was kind of instantaneous. We didn't know he was ill, and I think there's something very strange about a sudden death like that, an unexpected sudden death. All deaths of loved ones are hard, but that sense that, they're suddenly gone with no reason. It sort of rips the world in two for the people that are left behind, I think.
There's a sort of a strange moment where he had left his car parked and you couldn't find it.
Oh, that was awful. Because, of course, my brother and I were searching for his car. He'd left it, yeah, as you say, he'd left it parked somewhere. And we, you know, it took a while for us to understand that our desperate search for this car was kind of not just about the car. You know, it was about trying to find him again. And eventually we worked out that it had been towed, and we rung up the yard where they were keeping it. And I remember sort of saying to this guy on there, this poor guy, you know, I'm sorry, my dad couldn't collect the car. He died. You know, at this point, everything is just sort of weird. And this poor man was terribly upset. And I was like, no, it's fine. You know, he's died. And we had to take his death certificate to the impound place so he didn't have to pay a charge. It was so surreal. I mean, really, really weird.
You say you read books on grieving and on loss, and you read about those regular emotions, about grieving and denial. But you, of course, sort of what you're saying now, there was no sense to your father's death, and you said you didn't really recognize at that time any of those emotions.
No, and I think this is, I trained as a an academic. I was an academic historian for years. So I just thought to myself, right, what do you do when something, you know, that you don't know about has happened? You just get books and you read them. So I bought all these books on grief and they were so unhelpful. They all kind of said things about how it happens in stages. And I remember just at this point in that shock of recent grief where you feel like you're made of burning metal. I mean, you don't feel like you're a human at all. Of course, I didn't feel any of these. You know, I didn't know about all these stages and didn't know what they meant. And I got very angry with the books. So, yeah, I mean, I think in retrospect, those books, some of them said some very sensible things. But there was nothing to help me at that point. All the rest of my family, we were all just broken, you know.
At some point, of course, in the process, you start, for some reason or another, to dream about hawks.
Yes. I know, right? I mean, not what I expected, or I guess it's not a very usual response to grief. And I dreamt about one bird in particular. You know, I'd been a bird of prey obsessive, really, and a falconer for many years. And some years before that, I'd worked in this kind of zoo bird of prey center, and we had this wild hawk brought in. She'd knocked herself out while hunting. I think she'd hit a tree or something. And we had to sort of get her out of this box and just check she had no broken bones. And this bird was just incredible. I mean, I say in the book, she was like a sort of dusty grey colour with these starry dark orange eyes. And she was like a kind of granite cliff or a thundercloud. She was so wild, like a dinosaur. She was fine, and we took her outside and let her go, and she just flew through the air, and suddenly she was gone. It was like she'd found a sort of a gap or in the air or a rent in the air, and she just slipped through it. And it was that moment where she disappeared that I just kept replaying over and over again. And I think that was one of the reasons that I did this, well, rather weird way of coping with grief, I think. I don't recommend that anyone listening to this who suffered a big loss should go out and get a goshawk. You know, it's a little bit eccentric, right? But it was my route. And I think everyone does different things when they're faced with that kind of, you know, emotional crisis. Some people drink. Some people, you know, go to family. Some people go for long walks. Some people have inadvisable affairs and all those kind of things. And I got a goshawk.
You say from then on, that moment when you saw the hawk in this particular story,
yeah,
the hawk was inevitable.
Yeah.
What do you mean the hawk was inevitable?
Well, I guess I was looking for a way to escape being me. I know that sounds kind of, you know, really overblown, but this was my first big loss of a parent. And I think when a parent dies, particularly a very loved parent, Dad and I were really great friends as well as being a great dad. You don't know who you are anymore. Things that anchor you to your sense of identity are broken and snapped. The world becomes really weird and unrecognizable. And all the stories that you've told yourself about how it works don't seem to be true anymore. So, when I was a kid, I loved hawks. I loved birds of prey. They seemed these vital, living pieces of you know, exquisite wonder and transport and transcendence. And I guess that's what drew me to the hawk. It was going to be a great distraction. You know, I'd been a falconer for years, and I knew that training a hawk is a very, very difficult and complicated and distracting process. And I also knew that goshawks are pretty much the hardest birds of prey to tame. They're really, really highly strung. They're like kind of, you know, imagine a cross between Christopher Walken and a highly strung racehorse, right? They're kind of, you know, they have a reputation for being difficult and very bloodthirsty and strange. And I thought this is going to take me out of myself, you know. But it was all unconscious decisions. I think, you know, I was sort of driven towards the goshawk by compulsions I didn't really understand at the time.
How do you explain your obsession with birds? As a young child, it seems like it, in some ways, it came from your father, or at least your relationship with your father. You would go birding together, I guess.
Yeah. There's a lovely word in England, anorak. I think it's the same as kind of nerd or geek here. And Dad used to proudly declaim, you know, I'm a bit of an anorak, he'd say, and we'd laugh because I was too. Yeah, we used to go for walks together, and I was a bird obsessive, and he liked birds too, but his big thing was aeroplanes. He was a real aeroplane nut. He grew up in London during the Blitz in World War II, and of course, in those days, needing to know, look up and see aeroplanes was kind of a survival tactic, right? I mean, you know, you needed to know whether they were good ones or bad ones. And so we just used to wander around and look at the moving things in the sky together. And he really did, teach me to a way of looking at the world. And that was kind of, you know, sad. When he was gone, it was also a situation where I felt that the world was a little bit more lonely because I didn't have someone I shared an eye with, right? It sounds weird now, but yeah, I missed him a lot.
But and it's funny, it seems like your parents were pretty indulgent. I mean, there was a time when you were, I think you were 12, and you wanted to go see falconry in the field. And they said, go ahead. And it was this 12-year-old girl with a bunch of upper middle class, what, British men, I guess, in this field.
Upper class, upper class. Yeah, this was really funny. And I found out much later that the only reason they let me go with these guys is they'd done some serious kind of, you know, social background checks beforehand. It was all fine. So, yeah, I was invited out with these falconers. And it was so funny, seriously. I mean, at that point, you know, when you're very small, you just think that everyone's like you. And I was this, you know, 12-year-old schoolgirl, pretty much, you know, wearing my kind of waxed cotton English jacket and my Wellington boots. And I met these guys and I thought, yeah, I'm just like these guys. I'm a falconer too, right? And they were all, you know, they wore tweed. They drove very battered old Land Rovers. And one of them even offered me snuff, you know. I mean, this is, they were not like me. And I went out hawking with them and I watched them fly these goshawks that were like, you know, they were sort of like statuary, kind of these beautiful hawks. And that was the day I saw the first time, you know, because falconry is about, you know, the relationship with the bird of prey. But obviously birds of prey hunt. So one of these hawks caught a pheasant and it was the very strange and disturbing and compelling thing to witness. I'd never seen death before. And I guess, you know, part of what goshawks meant to me was tied up always with death, you know.
There's a story you tell of some of the hawks at this excursion this day. Refusing to return to their owners. They just land up in the trees. And I really loved this moment. This was something you were talking about earlier, this sense when you first, when you talked about that goshawk you had encountered at that training rehabilitation center, that it had slipped into another world. And the same thing happens here, that these goshawks, because they have a certain kind of personality. They can sort of sulk, I guess. And I wanted you to sort of talk about that.
Yeah.
But the other sense of it, or at least your interpretation of the moment at that moment, was that they had kind of slipped into another world for a time.
Absolutely. And one of the strangest things about all the cultures surrounding birds of prey, hawks and falcons and eagles and so on, over millennia, is how often they're used as, or they're seen as kind of symbols of things that can slip between this world and another world, the other world, the underworld, or a kind of different world, or the world of fairy, or any kind of sort of, or even heaven in some shamanic traditions, that, you know, these birds are supposed to take human souls to visit the other side and come back. And I guess all those stories are very old and they're working within us. And this sense that birds of prey are attached to the divine and to this crossing of borders is very deep in how we see them, even if we don't acknowledge it. And these sulky birds who'd basically just been fed too much and wanted to have a sleep, I mean, that's what they were doing. To me, they seemed like they were in another place because, you know, these guys were waving raw meat at them to try and get them to come down, and the birds just weren't even looking at them. And there was something about that radical awayness, that distance of those birds, that really, really chimed at me then. And I guess, again, was tied up in why goshawks when my dad died. But yeah, goshawks have had this, they've had this reputation as being these sort of willful, you know, they have moods, they have fits, they go into sulks, they go into kind of violent moods. And I remember laughing because, like, you know, during this time with my hawk Mabel, I kind of started to work out that when all these 19th century falconer guys were talking about these uncontrollable, hysterical hawks, they might have been talking actually about women. It was very funny. You know, they never thought that it was their behavior that made the hawks do any of this stuff. It was just something about the bird. And I was like, you know what? This is saying more about us than goshawks.
Well, this idea of these 19th century falconers projecting, as you say, all the male qualities that they figured were being threatened, as you say in the book, wildness and power and virility.
Yeah.
Of course, T.H. White is also projecting. This sort of brings us to this part of the story. Mm. Let's talk about T.H. White. You first found T.H. White's book in a bookshop, and you were only 8 years old. and you were really drawn. It seems like you were just drawn to the image of the goshawk on the cover.
Yeah, I was a shallow 8 year old, right? There was a picture of a goshawk on the cover, and I'm like, oh man, I'm getting this book. This is amazing, right? And it was a really good painting. And I'd just been devouring falconry books. You know, my superpower as a child was reading. You know, I didn't know what half the words meant, but I just used to read and read and read. So I'd read a lot of books on how to train hawks, and I knew how to do it the way that, you know, reading a lot of books about how to fly an aeroplane means you know how to do it. You know, I didn't know how to do it really, but I knew how, you know, the technical stuff. And I opened this book, and it was not like any falconry book I'd ever read before. It was weird. It was written in this very kind of flowery, romantic way. It was very personal. And pretty soon I realized this guy didn't know what on earth he was doing. And that really offended me as a child, right? I was like, you know, and he kind of, the hawk was suffering, clearly suffering at the hands of his ignorance. And, you know, I was absolutely outraged. And you know, I didn't understand what was going on in this book. I didn't understand that this was a book about things that weren't just hawks, you know. And he was a very sad and very interesting character, and I wanted to know more about him for this book.
It's interesting. You spend some time. I'm wondering why T.H. White. Why did you figure that his story you would put alongside yours? And we'll talk a little bit about sort of his sense of a hawk was very much different from your sense of a hawk, and that was an important theme. But initially, is that why you decided to include his story in yours?
I wasn't going to have so much of him in the book initially. He was always going to be there because, you know, for reasons that are kind of quite interesting, and I'll talk about those in a second. But basically what happened is I went to the University of Texas as I researched the book, and I went through all of his archives and notebooks and letters, and I began to be really haunted by him, right? These letters and notebooks are full of photographs and feathers, and there's bits where he's very drunk and his writing goes everywhere, and there's bits where he's cried on the page and you can see tear spots. I mean, really, really present. He was just there. And I wanted him to be more in the book. I felt very sad for him as a very poignant character. But I guess, you know, why initially is because when I was a kid and I read this book, even though I didn't really understand what on earth was going on, I began to realize that here was a man who went to get a goshawk and to tame it because he was running away from something. He was escaping something and flying towards this hawk, which is what I did years later, but for different reasons, right? So I got a goshawk because I was broken and I was grieving and I didn't want to be me anymore. And he got a goshawk, I think, because he didn't want to live all the fictions he was trying to live. So he was teaching at a school. He grew up in India, had a very violent childhood, and he was gay, which was not a brilliant thing to be if you were born in 1906 in Britain. And he couldn't really deal with the world he was living in. So he withdrew to try and find himself with this bird. So we both did sort of the same thing. And we both sort of used goshawks to try and do it.
You mentioned that for his, what he saw in his goshawk was, and this is how you put it in the book, a living expression of his dark desires, the ones that he had tried to repress. So, and this sort of mantra keeps coming up in the book, fey, fairy, feral, ferocious, and cruel.
Yeah, I mean, he was quite a sadistic character. And I suspect that came from his upbringing. You know, he was sent to prep school and he was beaten every night, and those sort of things leave big scars. And, you know, he saw that he would never act on any of these desires. He knew they were wrong. He felt deeply ashamed of them. And this is, you know, at the time. So he saw the hawk as all the things he was inside, but could never act on. It was this innocent, cruel thing. But the great irony, of course, is that as he tried to civilize the hawk and train it, he's doing exactly to the hawk as he was doing to himself all these years. And the more you read the book, this book, The Goshawk, that he wrote about this experience, the more it becomes heartbreaking, because the hawk almost, you know, the hawk needn't even be there. It's like he's punching himself in a mirror. And I just wanted to write about this because it seems to me that both he and I made the same mistake. Both of us used nature as a mirror of our own selves, of our own needs. We projected stuff into it. And of course, you know, but quite apart from that, there are real live birds there, you know, and we do this to nature, we do it to other people all the time. So I just thought it was a kind of it's a kind of big theme, that one.
There's a moment in the story of T.H. White where he's watched the really cruel end process of a fox hunt.
Yeah.
And he's judging the people who are sort of catcalling this fox and just shouting, you know, pleased that this carnage is going on. And the only one that he sort of singles out is not for blame. I think it's the huntsman.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that? I thought that was an interesting perception.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So T.H. White, for a while after he, you know, became a schoolmaster, was desperate to fit in. So he tried to become a gentleman. And one of the things that gentlemen did was fox hunt. And, you know, a very, very formal thing where you get on a horse and you follow a pack of hounds and the hounds find a fox and, you know, tear it apart. It's all pretty bloody. Yeah, and there's this moment where he sees a fox being dragged out of a drain and thrown to the hounds. I mean, it's kind of full-on sort of visceral horror. And he looks at all of the spectators and they're all cheering on the hounds and he finds this disgusting. Then he looks at the huntsman and what the huntsman is doing, the huntsman is looking after the hounds, right? He's the kind of, he's with the hounds and he's for the hounds and he's kind of the master of this pack. And he's dressed in a sort of bright pink kind of coat and he's blowing a formal commemoration of the death of the fox on this hunting horn, a mort it's called. And White finds this very moving, and he finds the huntsman innocent of all of the horrible kind of emotions that the rest of the people are experiencing, because he says he's close to the pack, he's one of them, and he can experience, you know, the death of the fox innocently because he's an animal like his pack. And that's why, I think, as I was saying, that's why the goshawk appealed to White. If he went hunting with a goshawk and he could identify with this hawk so much, just like the huntsman and his hounds, he could experience these kind of visceral, bloody deaths in the countryside that he kind of wanted to take place with total innocence, kind of spiritual innocence. And I thought that was a really, really kind of dark but fascinating movement, mental movement for him.
That's Helen MacDonald. Her memoir is H is for Hawk. The book was just released on paperback. She's in Utah today. At 7 tonight, she'll be reading from her book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. You can find the particulars on her website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Helen MacDonald is with us on the program today. Her acclaimed memoir, H is for Hawk, has just been released on paperback, and she's gone on book tour, which happens to include a stop here in Salt Lake City. We spoke with her yesterday about the story she tells of training a goshawk as a way of working through the grief of her father's unexpected death. These birds are intense and spooky. That's one of the words she uses in the book. She found her goshawk, Mabel, she names her, on the internet. Mabel had been bred in an aviary near Belfast, and at this point in the story, Helen has just met the breeder, who has with him two boxes, Helen's bird and a goshawk for another falconer. The breeder has a form with him, and they open the box to make sure they have the right bird.
Another hinge untied. Concentration. Infinite caution. Daylight irrigating the box. Scratching talons, another thump, and another thump. The air turned syrupy, slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle. And with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons, and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulls an enormous, enormous hawk out of the box. And in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine, two enormous eyes. My heart jumps sideways. She's a conjuring trick, a reptile, a fallen angel, a griffin from the pages of an illuminated bestiary, something bright and distant like gold falling through water, a broken marionette, of wings, legs, and light-splashed feathers. She's wearing jesses, and the man holds them. For one awful long moment, she's hanging head downward, wings open like a turkey in a butcher's shop, only her head is turned right way up, and she is seeing more than she has ever seen before in her whole short life. Her world was an aviary, no larger than a living room, and then it was a box. But now it is this, and she can see everything. the point source glitter on the waves, a diving cormorant 100 yards out, pigment flakes under wax on the lines of parked cars, far hills and the heather on them, and miles of sky where the sun spreads on dust and water and illegible things moving in it that are white scraps of gulls, everything startling and new stamped on her entirely astonished brain. Through all this, the man was perfectly calm. He gathered up the hawk in one practiced movement, folding her wings, anchoring her broad feathered back against his chest, gripping her scaled yellow legs in one hand. "Let's get that hood back on," he said tautly. There was concern in his face. It was born of care. This hawk had been hatched in an incubator, had broken from a frail bluish eggshell into a humid perspex box, and for the first few days of her life, this man had fed her with scraps of meat held in a pair of tweezers, waiting patiently for the lumpen, fluffy chick to notice the food and eat, her new neck wobbling with the effort of keeping her head in the air. All at once, I loved this man, and fiercely. I grabbed the hood from the box and turned to the hawk. Her beak was open, her hackles raised, her wild eyes were the colour of sun on white paper, and they stared because the whole world had fallen into them at once. 1, 2, 3. I tucked the hood over her head. There was a brief intimation of a thin, angular skull under her feathers, of an alien brain fizzing and fusing with terror. Then I drew the braces closed. We checked the ring numbers against the form. It was the wrong bird. This was the younger one, the smaller one. This was not my hawk. Oh.
Glad you ended with "oh." That's quite great.
I thought I would, yeah.
And then, of course, you have to... You meet the other hawk.
I know.
And you know immediately that that wasn't the right hawk. And you have to sort of go into this begging process.
Oh, seriously! I describe it in the book as being like kind of Greek tragedy. I'm like Medea on this quayside, kind of waving my arms around, you know, with sort of starry eyes. You know, I knew that this other bird, which we got out of the box after this one, the first one, was not my hawk. She was weird. She was just not. I looked into her eyes, and there was nothing there. And I dodged a bullet there. I discovered later that bird was very, very hard to tame, almost impossible. Really didn't trust humans at all. And my hawk, Mabel, was a sweetheart. I mean, she was very strangely placid and lovable. And I'm really glad that I made that decision, because I think if I got that other hawk, I mean, I don't know if there'd have been a book. I don't even know if I'd be here today. You know, it would have been a very different experience.
And there's almost a kind of intuition. I'm not sure if you'll cop to that in this book. And there are a couple of times when it comes up. There's another moment early on. You mentioned how you've spent the first few weeks of your life in an incubator.
Yeah.
You survived, but a twin brother didn't. And you didn't find that out until somewhat later. I think you were a late teen.
Yeah, I was late. I mean, the experience had been so deeply traumatic for my parents that they found it very hard to talk about. And of course, you know, back in the sort of early 70s, you know, hospitals advise things they don't advise now. You know, they said to the parent, you know, forget about it. You've got one. You know, don't talk about it. It's best to just forget. Yeah.
But you say you'd always felt a part of you was missing. So so when you learned of it, you were surprised, but you weren't so surprised.
Oh, no, it made total sense to me. I mean, it was, you know, I'd always, I mean, it sounds so melodramatic, I know, but I always felt that half of me was gone or half of me wasn't around. And I do think that this obsession I had with falconry and birds of prey was sort of caught up with this, actually, this sense that, you know, these birds are things that are free and they fly away, and yet they choose to come back to you of their own free will. And that's something about that seems to chime to me with this wish for something, some lost half of me to return.
That your obsession could have been born with that first loss, as you put it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I've heard you talk about how, in some ways, this book, where you're exposing yourself, is very un-British.
it is.
But so be it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I, you know, initially I didn't know there was going to be a book. I mean, obviously, you know, this stuff happened, and it was a very dark and beautiful experience this year with the hawk, when I really, it was like a trip to the underworld and back with this bird by my side. And it was only later that year that I began to realize there was a story about what happened that was older and bigger than just me. I mean, it wasn't just about my life. It was about how, it sounds so overblown, doesn't it? But it's about how life and death works, right? Yeah. And I started to write this book, and I thought, you know, it took a while, about 5 years before I had enough distance to get down and actually start writing. And initially, yeah, I was much more British. I thought, you know, I'll just write about the bird, right? The bird is the interesting thing here. And it just wouldn't work. I kept trying to kind of write chapters, and I wouldn't go anywhere. And there was this one day where I, you know, it was like a kind of, you know, a moment where I think I slammed my hands down on my writing desk and thought, you know, to hell with it. I have to do it. I have to just be, you know, really, really open about my emotional state. And I, you know, and as soon as I made that decision, the book started to fly. Mm. And I think it's partly because I think readers know when you're dissembling. Readers know when you're not telling everything. And you have to trust the reader. And as soon as I made that decision, I thought, okay, let's do it. And off I went.
You say in the book that to train a hawk, you have to watch it like a hawk.
Yeah.
You have to come to understand its moods. And you say that the longer you watch a hawk, the more subtleties you start to see. It's interesting that you even say that there was this moment where you started to notice in Mabel this narrowing of her eyes and this kind of frowning contraction of her beak, which you interpreted this, she's sort of happy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really funny. I mean, anyone who's got pets will know that, you know, after the longer you live with them and the longer you look at them very carefully, the more you kind of work out what they're feeling. And I think, you know, animals are creatures of deep emotion. I think that's how they work, most of them. And yet it's possible if you live with a goshawk to know when a goshawk is laughing. I know that sounds like a stretch, but, you know, we think of these birds, these goshawks, generally as kind of things like feathered shotguns. And I discovered that I could play with my hawk. I'd throw her bits of paper scrunched into paper, little paper balls, and she'd catch them in her beak and throw them back to me, and we'd play catch. And as she was doing this, she did this extraordinary expression on her face, which was like a kind of glove puppet expression. I can't really put it into words. With these little kind of half-closed eyes and sort of scrunched up tiny feathers around her beak. Yeah, goshawk laughter, you know, and this is, I mean, it's always really lovely when you're training an animal to be able to enter into its kind of mental state like that in your imagination. But as the book says, you know, that this also has some serious knock-on and consequences if we're as broken and grieving as I am.
Well, you mentioned the poet John Keats, who referred to this chameleon ability to recreate one's self in another character. And you write about this kind of recreation, you said, always came pretty easily to you, in some ways too easily.
Yeah, I've always been one of those people that, you know, I don't know, I don't know how to describe it really, but I've always been like ludicrously empathetic. Mm-hmm. You know, a friend of mine said, oh, it's because you're Irish, you know. So I don't think it's that. But yeah, when I was small, I mean, maybe as a consequence of that early loss of my twin, sometimes I would spend a lot of time watching birds through binoculars and looking at them so carefully that I used to sort of feel that I was them. And I think it's just something that I've always done. And it was an escape from myself a little bit, I think. And I had a really happy childhood, but there was this need to feel that I could be other things as well, other animals, other birds, and fly away from my little kind of, you know, my bedroom and up into the trees, right? Mm. And I think that was an okay thing to do. But then when my father died, I really didn't want to be me anymore. And identifying with a hawk so closely, which is almost inevitable in the process of training and taming it, was a willed kind of act of disappearance. I just wanted to be this bird. I wanted to be much more like a bird than a person. And I wanted to take flight. And as that year went on with the bird, I began to kind of lose sight of who I was. It was a very weird experience.
I want to come back to that in a moment.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, though, you actually refer to the way a hawk moves a couple of times this way. Life is faster for her. Mm-hmm. Time runs slower.
Yeah.
Her eyes, you say, at one point can follow the wing beats of a bee as easily as ours follow the wing beats of a bird. Would you talk about that, just the fact that it's almost like you say, it's just everything is stimulus for it. There's almost no thinking about it. It's all reaction.
Yeah, goshawks are famously very nervous birds, and part of that is because they live, they just live much, much different, you know, very much faster lives than we do, and they react to things before we even know those things have happened. So, yeah, so let's just sort of, you know, we sort of routinely assume that pretty much all the animals in the world see the world kind of the way we do. I mean, maybe not, you know, worms or bats or something, but we think of birds as seeing pretty much the same world as us. And they really don't. You know, for example, their colour vision is you know, completely superior to ours, right? So we have three different colour receptors in our eyes, and they have four. They can see colours that we can't. You know, they can see ultraviolet light, you know. They can see, it's speculated, they can see the sort of magnetic lines of force that kind of go across the globe. They can sense them at least. They can see polarized light. You know, their world is so much more complicated than ours, and it's impossible for us to imagine. There's a bit in the book where I say it's a bit like the difference between black and white television and color television. Mm. You know, we're black and white, they're color. We, you know, you can't imagine color TV from watching black and white TV. And yeah, and they live in a world that's much faster than ours. So things that we see as very, very, very fast, they see as very, very slow. So they have problems, for example, following TV pictures very clearly, because we see it as a kind of moving image, and they can track each bar kind of moving down the screen. I mean, it's really interesting how different their world is. And that makes them able to hunt, right? So
yeah,
when you see a bird snapping at an insect in midair, the reason it can do that is because everything in that world is slower. It's kind of like, you know, that whole thing with the Matrix way back when Neo can kind of bend and watch the bullet go past.
Right.
I mean, those birds live in bullet time. So obviously you can't really live in that time. You know, it was always just in my imagination.
I love how you describe how everything about a hawk is tuned and turned to hunt and kill. And you say there's this moment when if you would suck air through your teeth and make a squeaking noise like an injured rabbit, that all the tendons in Mabel's toes would just squeeze tightly. Like immediately became focused, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that when someone hits your knee with a hammer and you kick, you know, it's completely
right.
Unconscious. And it was quite scary. So yeah, so when they have these sort of innate responses, and one of them, this is, you know, such dark stuff for a, you know, radio interview. One of them is when they hear the squealing of an injured animal, goshawks have very powerful talons and claws, and their feet just instantaneously contract to try and, you know, kill whatever it is they're holding. Mabel was a baby, right? So she didn't really know what that sound was for. So I'd found that she would make that noise to all sorts of other stimuli. So ATM machines beeping would make her do it, bicycles squeaking. And of course, there was this awful moment where I'm standing there with her in the house. And, you know, they have this really powerful ratchet mechanism in their claws, so that actually it doesn't take any effort to kind of keep gripping with this numbing grip. It actually takes effort for them to let go. So there's this baby in a pram outside the window, and it starts to cry, and she does this killing, crushing grip. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of freaked me out a bit, actually.
Yeah. There's also a moment where she foots you. That is, she...
Yeah. That was my fault.
That was your fault.
Yeah.
You mentioned, but you were trying to figure out what was wrong with her. Would you mention what she does? Because she basically grips your uncovered, unprotected forearm.
So basically, yeah, I had some bit of meat in my... So you keep your hawk on a gauntleted left fist, obviously. You don't really want to kind of carry around a goshawk on your bare hand. Although I've known people who do it, and then, of course, their friends make the rabbit noise, and then their people regret carrying it around on their bare hands. So basically, so I was... She struck out with one foot and grabbed my ungloved right hand, and it was my fault. I had a bit of meat in there. I mean, this, you know, it wasn't something that she would naturally do. She wasn't aggressive at all. And I can tell your listeners that being grabbed by a goshawk is, in the immortal words of the writer Stephen Bodio, like sticking your hand into an electric light socket. I mean, it's really painful.
Yeah.
It's, you know, absolutely phenomenally powerful. It's not just that they have this powerful grip, it's that they, when they grab you, they punch you with incredible force, and then they kind of, you know, they drive their talons in. So, yeah, it gave me a real sense of, you know, yeah, I mean, those poor rabbits, you know.
But what's interesting is you say that you were trying to figure out what was wrong with her.
Yeah.
Why did she do that? And you say, really, it was something that was wrong, not with her, but with you. You were becoming anxious. And this is when you really write about that kind of transformation going on, that you were becoming too much a hawk, is how you put it. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you write about this anthropologist who had this took this trip to northeastern Siberia, interested in how hunters saw that relationship between human an animal.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was trying to work out how to describe this experience of sort of feeling like I'd become a hawk. And, you know, I mean, it really was bad. I remember, you know, I used to avoid people. I remember one day when the mailman knocked on the door and I suddenly found myself hiding behind the sofa, right? I mean, I was very goshawk-like. Yeah, I found this, you know, that I couldn't use psychoanalytic stuff to describe this. It just wasn't working to try and use attachment theory or Klein or Freud or all of these things to try and get across how it felt to feel that you were a hawk. And I found this amazing work by this anthropologist, Rane Villeslev, about the Yukaghi people in Siberia that he went to live with. And they did a lot of hunting there, and they had this extraordinarily awesome way of hunting, right? So what you do if you want to hunt caribou is that you dress in caribou skins, including the horns and everything, and then but there's more, you know, you also take upon yourself some part of the soul of a caribou. It's a willed act, this taking upon yourself this part of a caribou soul. And then you go outside with a rifle as well. Obviously, caribou don't tend to carry rifles, but you go outside and the caribou will recognize you as one of their own and they will come towards you. And obviously, this doesn't end well for the caribou. And Rilislev was told that you must not do this too much. If you do this too much, you start to lose your humanity. You start to lose your own soul, and you become too much a caribou. And there are some extraordinary stories that he tells about hunters who get lost, who find themselves in villages full of people they don't recognize, who give them lichen, to eat. This one hunter who started to forget things, he remembered he had a wife, but he couldn't remember her name, and then realized that the people were reindeer, you know, and he'd started to go too far. And that was what it was like. It really was this sense that I had forgotten. I'd completely forgotten what it was like to be a person. And that was scary. And I only realized what I'd done, really, when I was at my father's memorial in this sacred space in a church in London, when it finally struck me that I'd been a complete idiot.
Among the lessons you say you learned from this experience with Mabel was how you feel more human once you have known what it's like to be not human.
Yeah.
Would you absolutely talk about that?
Yeah. Okay. I guess it was one of those sort of transformation lessons. Okay. So, I mean, I in my imagination become this hawk, you know, and it's very weird talking about this now because it does seem so unbelievable. Okay. But I really felt that I had feathers. I felt I could, I mean, obviously I knew I couldn't fly, but when I was running after the hawk as she flew and hunted across the frosty English hillsides, I was transported. And then once I'd realized that I was projecting all my needs and all my kind of grief onto her, I saw her as this thing that I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a human anymore. I realized more about what it means to be a human. And Mabel taught me some other things too. And, you know, she taught me, I guess, with watching her hunting for her own dinner, how we don't really see death anymore. It happens behind walls and, you know, be it animal or human, it's not something that's part of our lives anymore. It taught me that we're none of us here very long, you know, and it taught me that the boundaries between life and death are very, very small. And, you know, we all want to live and, you know, everything fights to stay alive. And then sometimes that is no longer the case. It's always eventually no longer the case. So I guess, yeah, that experience with the hawk taught me a lot about what it was like, what it is to be a human, partly by thinking that I wasn't one.
Right.
Yeah.
I also like the part where you say you learned that there's a danger that comes in mistaking the wildness we give a thing for the wildness that animates it. It seems like that was a big takeaway, this idea of just recognizing the wildness.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you carefully think about all the meanings that we give a wild animal, all those meanings that mean wildness and ferocity, or, you know, the sort of ways in which we think of hawks as naturalizing things like violence. And, you know, we name all our fighter jets after hawks and falcons, right? I mean, it's like, if hawks and falcons do it, then we do it. It's natural. I mean, there's a lot of symbolic weight that we give these birds. It's all about us. And that's kind of what I fell into with this bird. I saw her as this dark spirit, this fetch of northern woods that I could race after and become. If you carefully look past those human meanings, you can almost catch a glimpse of what these birds really are, which are these fascinating, deeply inhuman, exquisite creatures that are not us. And I think that's the great magic of animals, that even though she was not me and not a human, we shared this life together. It was amazing.
Helen MacDonald, who joined us from a studio in Los Angeles yesterday. Her book is H is for Hawk, which is just now out in paperback. She's in Utah tonight at the King's English Bookshop at 7. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.